You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 174A by Rudolf Steiner. I believe it's 12 lectures, entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History, translated by Christiane O'Brien. This is Lecture 2, given on the 3rd of December, 1914 in Munich. A lecture such as that given the day before yesterday might easily have given the impression of being one-sided and extolling the virtues of one folk soul over another on the basis of mere sympathy. If a spiritual researcher should speak of these matters on a basis of pure sympathy or passion, one might assume that what they said would have little value in spiritual scientific terms, that what they had to say, being saturated with such fervor, must be fundamentally and inwardly untrue. Now, however what was said yesterday, despite being connected with the deepest knowledge of what present-day spiritual science is permitted to say, may appear to you, it proceeds from the ways and means in which the modern spiritual researcher has to relate to one or another of the folk souls. We know from the basics of anthroposophy that we do not understand the term folk souls in the same way as expressed by abstract concepts current in the exoteric world. Quite specific beings, beings of the rank of archangel, can be read about in the lecture cycle titled The Mission of the Folk Souls. Beings with a higher consciousness than human beings direct the affairs of nations. We look aloft to these folk souls, speak of them as real and present beings, as real as we ourselves are. How can the soul spiritual element in human beings relate to these folk souls? Let us begin by framing this question. We know how human consciousness oscillates as it alternates between sleeping and waking. We know that people have to awaken into their physical and etheric bodies, and that between falling asleep and waking up, they dwell in their astral body with their I, capital. Once the person between falling asleep and waking up is outside their physical body with their astral and I, they are in a region which, as regards their relationship with the folk soul, to whom they belong in a particular incarnation, is quite different from that in which the individual is when they are in their physical body. They are born into the area of their folk soul, as defined by their language and related factors. How does this folk soul work upon a human soul, affecting those elements removed from the physical and ether bodies during sleep, yet which inhabit its physical body when awake? How does the folk soul of a people, to which a person belongs, affect the individual soul? It works, in fact, only during the time when a person has dived back into their physical body on waking, between waking and falling asleep. They are then immersed in the forces of their physical and ether bodies, and, submerged within these forces, are also what I would call the tentacles of the folk soul of the people to which an individual especially belongs in that incarnation. We are not only immersed in our physical bodies, we also sink into a certain element of our folk soul, living between waking and sleeping within the processes of our physical bodies and within our folk soul. We experience in community with our folk soul during waking consciousness, only that our folk soul does not speak directly into our fully conscious I, but that it speaks primarily through our ether body into the subconscious of our astral body, that it gives us a certain direction, tinging and adding nuance to our feelings and temperament. That is the basis upon which we relate to it. Anyone able through initiation to observe what is entailed in a human being diving down into their physical body will observe a meeting with their folk soul upon submerging into their physical state. They will also see something else. Once I speak about it, you will soon realize that within what the spiritual researcher has to say about one folk soul or another, absolute objectivity has to be maintained. Spiritual researchers live in those moments when, by rightly strengthening their soul spiritual element, by making it possible to be conscious independently of their body, by observing where the human being exists, they can observe them even when they are outside their physical bodies with their astral and eye. There, the spiritual researcher can see that each human soul, when unconscious between falling asleep and waking, lives and is submerged within the compass of the folk souls under consideration for that time. The human being is with the folk soul of their nation once they have dived into their physical bodies. But while they are in a state of sleep, they are in company with all the other folk souls significant for that time, with the exception of the folk soul with whom they dwell when awake in the physical. Given the opportunity, the spiritual researcher may become acquainted with the idiosyncrasies of other folk souls, because as soon as he or she becomes conscious of their own eye in their body-free state, they commune equally in soul and spirit with other folk souls, as when they are living with their own folk soul in physical life. This makes it quite impossible, unlike in cases of habitual emotional fervors, to speak preferentially about this or that folk soul. But when the spiritual researcher is consciously with the other folk souls, then their consciousness shows them that every person, between falling asleep and waking up, is unconsciously connected with all the other folk souls, albeit slightly differently from the connection they have with their own folk soul. When diving down into their physical bodies, humans learn to know individual folk souls in their fundamental characteristics, largely as regards their active influences on themselves, even if on a subconscious level. During sleep or when initiated, one becomes acquainted with the other folk souls, not individually, but in relation to their cooperative work. Only one's own folk soul is not present. The others work together as if in a round or circle dance, and one is alive within this circulating activity in the same way as one lives with one's own folk soul during daylight physical life. There, one coexists, not with the particular features of that one folk soul, but amongst their cooperative working. There is only one circumstance through which, during body-free existence, that is, during sleep, one can be as if judged. One can quite certainly be condemned to be torn away from the usual communal circling of the folk souls, to be with only a single, in quotes, foreign folk soul. Please understand me correctly. Being alone with a single foreign folk soul is abnormal. It can be achieved if one particularly passionately hates that other folk soul. In doing this, in being alone with this single alien folk soul, in the same way as one lives with one's own folk soul in waking life, one is condemned to being torn away from the circling activity of the other folk souls. Yes, these are objective truths resulting from spiritual research. They show you that the adage, often iterated by spiritual science, is bitterly serious. That what we encounter as external reality is Maya, the great deception. And that behind this illusory veil lie truths about which those merely content with the veil of Maya can not only understand nothing with their reason, but do not wish to understand anything with their will. There are many, many people nowadays who are not yet able to picture what lies beyond this veil of Maya, who cannot therefore grasp that there is an invisible, supra-sensible world in which relationships more utterly different than can be dreamt of exist between human souls and folk souls. If you take spiritual science seriously, when it points to spheres connected with your lives, you also have to stomach it when spiritual science describes relationships in spiritual worlds into which it is quite uncomfortable to plunge, be it only in thought, while your will also balks at it. We don't want to take the plunge. We want the truth about many things to be different, so that not only our reason, but our will won't resist those intensely serious matters of which spiritual science has to tell, and which we allow to pass through our souls. On the basis of feelings, which can be stirred by contentions, as just outlined, we sense that the principle to which our spiritual movement subscribes, which does not differentiate as to race, color, nationality, or any such like, is so fundamentally bound with the deeper foundations of our movement that it is quite idiotic for anyone taking spiritual scientific verities seriously not to represent this primary principle. It is total idiocy to hate the being of a particular folk soul, because in our most profound humanity and at our lowest subconscious level, this would entail condemning ourselves to being close to that folk soul during sleep, in the same way as we live with our own folk soul during our waking hours. Because the normal mode of existing with folk souls during sleep is this: to participate in the entire circling round of folk souls active at a given time. Also that human beings are not allowed to become one-sidedly partial, both of which conditions are ensured by the wise order of the world. We have often emphasized that what human beings have to undergo in the years ahead, what they will experience between death and a new birth, depends to a certain extent on the after effects of their lives in physical bodies between birth and death. From what we have just discussed, we can infer that being together with one's folk soul is integral to this embodied life. I said that this communing with our folk soul gives rise to certain nuances or tinges. We take with us through the gate of death into spiritual worlds what our folk soul has activated in our soul spiritual constitution by way of motives and impulses, and we have to gradually slough these off. If we think about this, it will become instantly clear that the manner in which we have lived with our folk soul will affect our standing as to the after effects immediately following death. Let's observe two nations in light of this, the Russian and French people. It is in the nature of folk souls that they are active differently within their consciousness from the way in which human beings are in theirs. How are humans active in their consciousness? They direct their gaze toward the horizon of outer facts and are also able to turn it inward onto their own soul. We know that people differ from one another in some respects. One group may belong to Goethe, whose gaze rests objectively on things. Another group to Schiller, who is more concerned with individual inner vision, and from that position carries out all that he achieves. Folk souls also share slight similarities, but are only approximately similar, because their consciousness is of quite a different order to human consciousness. Folk souls relate variously to diverse individuals belonging to their folk or people. In directing their gaze outward, it will be more of a will-filled gaze, a look that will send its impetus into individual members of a people. They work objectively and centrifugally when turning toward an individual, or they might exist more introspectively. Such folk souls are less inclined to subscribe, one could express it thus, to folk soul realism in expanding over an individual, and instead rather to folk soul idealism, which dwells more pensively within. To this latter inclination does especially the French folk soul belong. This French folk soul, as it at present permeates the French people, experiences a certain suspension or halt in its consciousness caused by looking back to an earlier time.
I have often drawn attention to the way in which we possess our usual physical waking consciousness, because we dive down into our spatial body. After death, we owe our consciousness to time we spend looking back at our previous lives. We already have an inkling of what is characteristic of a higher consciousness that evolves not in space, but over time. So it will not be very difficult to grasp what kind of consciousness the French folk soul has. It ignites its own self by looking back to ancient Greece, because it is in a fundamental sense recapitulating, reawakening ancient Greekness. Ancient Greece is resurrected in the French folk soul, just as the ancient Egypto-Chaldea of the third post-Atlantean epoch is revived in the Italian folk soul. Hence the Italian folk soul has the potential to revive, primarily, the sentient soul in individuals belonging to the Italian people. The intrinsic nature of the French folk soul stimulates the intellectual soul in individuals, as can be proven in many instances. Even historical facts become wonderfully explicable when informed by these general results of spiritual science. A few such things may be mentioned here. Just consider, what was a unique aspect of the Egyptian folk soul? Astrology existed then, directly affecting souls. The souls of this people looked outward at the movements of heavenly bodies, not seeing the material processes that today's people see, but perceiving the activity of spiritual beings. They related to the entire cosmos in the same way as a person relates to other human beings, knowing that through every feature of their physiognomy, a soul is gazing back at them. All physiognomy was seen in this way by the ancient Egyptians. The soul element in nature was perceived. The sense of onward progress into more recent times lies in the fact that what was previously akin to an elemental capacity is now ignited directly in the human physical body, becoming its inwardness in our more recent fifth post-Atlantean age. Just as what the Egyptian underwent was of a more elemental nature, what an Italian experiences in recapitulation as soul spiritual in their sentient soul is now more inward, has been internalized. What could be more of an internalization than the Egyptian astrology in Dante's title Divine Comedy? Correctly reconceived ancient Egyptian astrology, but now internalized. One could similarly demonstrate the rekindling of ancient Greek qualities, not in individual French consciousness, but in the effects of their folk soul's impetus. Particulars of the latest inventions could be followed up, but insufficient seriousness tends to be brought to such investigations. Greece, and even the term barbarian, as it once called other nations, has resurfaced. It can be confirmed that in its deeper impulses, I do not mean consciously, ancient Greece is revived in all French literature and art, as indeed it should be. We have before us a folk soul that has processed and assimilated all that existed in ancient Greece, a folk soul that affects individuals extraordinarily strongly, asserting itself and taking hold of the individual. Consequently, when the individual French soul plunges down daily into its ether and physical bodies, it is also submerged in the weaving essence and incisively definitive activity of its folk soul. It encounters this impetus as sharply contoured. For this reason, the French individual, in absorbing such starkly definitive weaving activity from their folk soul into their physical body, lives primarily within this rather than within an elemental sense of self, lives more in the imaginative picture they have created, the epitome of what a French person is, that wells up from their folk soul. They live in the image of the French person, and with this image is associated all that has great significance for them, glory, and so forth. The French person exists in their own image, which wells up from their ether body. This fantasy image is powerfully imprinted and becomes enmeshed with the soul spiritual identity of the individual. It accompanies them as an intensely articulated aspect of their ether body, even after death, into the spiritual world. This ether image is very hard to get rid of. The image they have made of themselves adheres tightly and is firmly bound to them. The attitude of the Russian folk soul toward its individuals is quite different. Unlike the French, this Russian folk soul does not have anything to recapitulate in the sense of other post-Atlantean cultures, such as that of the French. It is a youthful folk soul who impinges little on ether bodies. That is why, on submerging into their physical bodies, little of incisive character or sharpness of contour attaches to the single individual belonging to this Russian folk soul. However, their etherically woven fantasy images are brought into spiritual worlds after death. These are some of the differences in the ways individual souls relate to their folk souls after death. On the one hand, we see the hosts of such single souls who have gone through death, taking with them sharply configured images of themselves. And on the other, we see young souls belonging to a young folk soul in the East, ascending and bringing with them few sharply defined, albeit ether-suffused, images. Now, we are standing, as I have often explained, on the threshold of that great event of coming times, the appearance of Christ in a most especial form. I need not expound on this in detail today. Ahead of him, since the last third of the 19th century, and as a fighter fittingly preparing humanity for this Christ event, goes that spirit, whom we call Michael, conquering harbinger of the Sun Spirit. Now, everything depends on this event, imminently to dawn over humanity, being rightly prepared for in spiritual realms. Yet this can only take place if in spiritual worlds work proceeds on the pure elaboration of the future Christ to appear in ethereal form to humankind. For this, it is necessary for Michael, in his capacity as harbinger of the Sun Spirit, to fight a battle in spiritual worlds. For this battle, he needs the aid of souls, who, as a result of their bodies, bring aloft with them only few sharply contoured fantasy images. Thus we see the spirit Michael, and among his followers a number of Russian souls, fighting for the purity of the spiritual horizon, in grueling battle with souls emanating from the West, and bringing with them harshly defined fantasy images. These need to be diffused and dissolved. We observe how this battle between East and West has been in preparation since the last third of the 19th century, and intense fight in service of humanity's future, a fight entailing the spiritual East of Europe countering the spiritual West of Europe, spiritual Russia waging a robust onslaught against spiritual France. That, my dear friends, is among the most shattering events of the present, seeing how, to the same extent as down here on tactical fronts, the great deception of the physical bond between West and East is being perpetuated, while over there in spiritual worlds the harsh clash of Eastern Europe, Russia, is directed against the European West, France. Here we have one of those instances that have such a shattering effect on the spiritual researcher, where what is behind the veil of the outer world can be seen to be the exact opposite of what appears to be taking place down here in the land of delusion. But I wish to exhort you, again and again, not to believe that you can speculate about such things. Anyone inferring from what I said about an isolated instance that the spiritual can be the opposite of what takes place among Maya's illusion, who imagines they should seek the spiritual in the opposite of physical Maya, would be very seriously mistaken. For there are cases where events in the spiritual world proceed exactly as in the physical. Between these two opposing circumstances, one of which is the connection between France and Russia on physical and spiritual levels, are any number of gradations. Nowadays, there is little feeling for the impetus out of which genuine spiritual science has to be communicated. Our times have, to some extent, become, if I may put it like this, frivolous as regards what appears newsworthy to individuals. Precious little is asked about the responsibility behind what is to be communicated for the one who is focusing on the connection between the physical and spiritual worlds. Not for personal reasons, but by way of illustration, may I add something about my lecture of the day before yesterday. You see, in that public lecture, where I could naturally only speak in exoteric terms, I was, nevertheless, not speaking as exoterically as you might believe. I would be happy if, especially in such lectures, you would consider the cultural task spiritual science has, namely, what is behind the selection and manner of expressing what has to be said. These are not arbitrary ideas, randomly cobbled together. Take just one example. I said that if one wants to evaluate the relationships between individual European nations in this war, one should proceed historically. For instance, by considering that Austria's Balkan mission was at the behest of English politics, that basically everything that ensued for Austria came as a consequence of all it carried out on behalf of English imperatives. I said that one has to take account of this, and that as a result Austria, and with it Germany, came particularly to oppose Russia, that England abandoned its own task to fight against Germany, while Central Powers came into conflict with Russia. And also because of Austria, motivated by England, being assigned the latter's Balkan mission. And further, by going to the Turks' aid when the intention was to hold back the influences of the Russian East. Obviously, in an exoteric lecture intended for the wider public, one can only hint at what might affect sensitivities in the positive ways they ought to be affected today. Yet what lies behind this issue? Externally, one sees English politics on the side of the Russians, which, precisely due to its English deed, has had its consequences. We see that externally. The spiritual researcher, seeing this in the spiritual world, can make a unique discovery, a highly idiosyncratic discovery. Let's imagine that the spiritual researcher takes a certain viewpoint, looking upward from below. They would take a point of perspective below the physical plane and look upward toward the astral plane. They might also make this point to be above the astral plane. Then they would see what unfolds on the physical plane, while at the same time seeing what transpires on the astral plane. They would blend these perspectives. You see, if one looks up from below, or from above downward, through the astral plane, one can see through the astral to the physical and vice versa. Now, looking at the physical, one sees England fighting Turkey, since Turkey has declared war on Russia. But that is merely Maya illusion, for in truth the astral being of England is fighting with Turkey against Russia. So that one has the theatrical dimension that, in the northwest, England is for Russia, and in the southeast, England is for Turkey, that is, fighting against Russia. It is just that one fact is pivotal for the physical, the other for the astral plane. If one faces the world with this kind of knowledge, one feels, naturally, one can't share knowledge of this kind externally with the public, and yet one is prompted to pick out this one point about England's fickle capriciousness in the East. That this fact was chosen is a result of knowing its spiritual context. It is with this example that I wish to illustrate the responsibility with which one has to assemble individual truths while also being responsible for the manner in which they are conveyed. If one's occult responsibility is properly sensed, one will not randomly cobble something together in the manner of modern wordsmiths and journalists. But what has to be expressed needs to be gathered from the very being and effects of the time. It is certainly not for personal reasons, but simply to alert you that I tell you that spiritual science, in approaching the world fully responsibly, ought to be taken very seriously, and not confused with what journalism and copywriting puts about, nor the way it mixes material, all of which is a very long way from a feeling of responsibility toward the spiritual powers of our time. Especially at this time, my dear friends, I may be permitted to draw a little attention to the seriousness of spiritual science, for in many respects our time shows us a serious countenance, an extremely earnest visage. And only those will weather this period well who understand how to honor this stern countenance. In order to underline this more firmly, I would like to bring before your souls a connection interesting to pupils of spiritual science. It has often been said that spiritual science did not in truth enter the present because it sprang up at the will of someone or other, or because someone had been personally inclined to make it their ideal and to spread it to other people, but because now is the age when spiritual beings, who had previously barred this gate to truths later to be revealed to humanity, have now opened it, so that this wisdom can flow down into human souls. We're heading toward a time when people must ever increasingly receive this wisdom, which cannot just be absorbed by the soul in the form of abstract concepts, nor merely as gray intellectual ideas. We are approaching a time when what we call imagination wants to flow into human souls and human feelings. If one could but see through to this, one would say, "There they hang above the landscape, like heavy clouds before a storm, hanging in the spiritual world, waiting to flow into human feelings, waiting for human souls to mature." Yes, this is how our time is. Indeed, it is. Now, there is a peculiar law. The imaginative element that is wanting to enter into human souls, but cannot yet be received as imagination into a given age, projects a Morgana Le Fay-like image, a quantum mirage, down as far below the physical plane as it is situated above it. These imaginations elicit in human beings passions, feelings, urges, and instincts, which are enacted in the form of antagonism. If you take today's eruptions of instincts, the passions with which people abuse each other, they are nothing other than the results of imaginations, which the peoples of Europe should be absorbing, but which cannot descend, and which are instead reflected on the physical plane in the human subconscious in the form of instincts and passions that oppose the truth. We can basically say that everything we are currently experiencing by way of instincts and passions being projected is an expression of the fact that renewed imaginations wish to break into the world, into human cultural evolution. All that the war so often and so tragically propels to the surface is distorted imagination, which humanity cannot grasp. Then again, and this never strikes me as being entirely unimportant, I would remind you that one should not say, "Every war is transformed imagination." Wars can be something quite different. Today's is as I described. Generalizing, which affects knowledge of the physical plane, has no significance for the spiritual world. Here, matters have to be researched separately and individually. I would like to introduce a phenomenon from a particular angle in order to explain it. Nowadays we see how members of different peoples pursue each other in hate, how they insult each other. Where does this originate? Now, since we have in deepest earnestness accepted the nature of repeated earthly lives, it should not appear particularly inconceivable to us that the soul, over the course of its repeated lives, passes through various nationalities. Someone presently living out their incarnation in a German body may already be inwardly preparing to incarnate in an English body. Someone at the moment experiencing their incarnation in an English body may well be preparing in their deepest recesses for a German incarnation. Human beings are already dual entities. They are dualities. Externally, we appear to the world, not only with regard to our physically perceptible exterior, but in respect of much else too, quite justifiably in our physical bodies as they are linked with the weaving being of their folk soul. Yet that which will make our next incarnation a totally different one begins to assert itself inwardly. Now, human beings, amongst much else toward which they feel enmity, are most frequently an enemy of their own inmost being. They are most often in conflict with themselves, not realizing that it is their own inner nature that they are fighting. Take an English person who is predestined through their soul's innermost impetus to be a German in their next incarnation. Today we see them fighting their own inner nature, fighting against their next German incarnation. This comes to expression in their shameless insulting of all things German. Glimpsing their future objective in a German body, they rage against what exists as their inmost being in the spiritual world. Fundamentally, this is a soul's dispute with itself, and only externally among the Maya is it a case of berating those across the channel in Central Europe. Basically, what is being cursed is their own soul. Therein lies the deep tragedy, which people have to overcome throughout their feelings and inner motivations. When matters become bitterly serious, and they compare external Maya with what exists within. This is how we can see the folk souls as real living beings who interfuse and permeate each single separate individual. What each person experiences, they experience in conjunction with their folk soul. In outer life, on the physical plane, people oppose each other. Each nation blames the other for the war, believing they are saying something noteworthy. What is this mutual accusation of guilt? The karma of each nation and that of the other nation in question both depend, of course, on what their folk soul is experiencing within each nation and the impulses being directed into each individual's ether and thence also astral body. This is how individual nations live side by side with each other in relationships that are expressions of their folk soul with folk soul karma. When the former, through the latter, experiences something or other, when this or that happens through this interrelation, it does not take place without being connected with the deepest karma. Inasmuch as a folk soul is a self-contained entity, national karma also exists. Whereas in outer life we believe that one nation harms another in some way, it transpires that each nation's experience is one of national karma. If one nation causes the downfall of another, what takes place in the defeated nation is something it has itself caused through its own karma. If one speaks in the crude terms prevalent in external life, about the rights of this side or the other. This is really no different from an old man seeing next to them a child full of youthful vigor and asking, "Why am I getting older? Why is decay increasingly evident? I see that the child is stealing my energy. By growing up, that child is taking my strength." Rather than acknowledging naturally declining strength, the old person succumbs to illusion. They wouldn't do this, yet I have heard the like of it. Quote, "That child is depleting my strength," close quote. You immediately appreciate that this is nonsense because the causal connection lies within each individual being. It is like this with the karma of peoples. They live alongside one another, and if the one triumphs over the other, the victory is for their karma, even though their victory signifies defeat for the other people. Their defeat is provoked by their own karma. So, we see that spiritual science is peace bestowing. Though, on the other hand, it understands that opposing forces simply have to work against each other. It is precisely in instances such as these that one can hope that attention will be directed toward the fact that spiritual science does not toy with sensational concepts. But the science of the spirit, when taken in its bitter seriousness, can really course through our souls, shaking and rattling them, and making of the individual who takes it seriously a different being. We must well and truly focus on this, just how superficially we sometimes regard spiritual science as a mere game of reasoning, and how we should actually regard it as something that can make of human beings a completely different entity. Much by way of understanding correlations will result if you admit to this. If two people have differing views of an issue playing out within their sight, one of them will generally be wrong. It will be easily verifiable that one of them is incorrect. But a person's individual life differs from the lives of nations. The lives of nations cannot be equated with the lives of individuals, and neither should one believe that the deeds of nations can be subject to the same judgments as regards their motivations as can those of individuals. Otherwise, one would judge in a way one never would, had one the slightest idea, of the relationships between nations, such as, for instance, if one were to maintain that war had to be declared on Germany because it had damaged Belgium's neutrality, as has been said, one would have to declare war on moral grounds. In politics, it is sheer nonsense to invoke the same laws to which the individual is rightly subject. It is quite obvious that Germany's interests call for an advance into Belgium, and England's that this doesn't happen. The moment one frankly admits that interests lie here or there, one is faced with a situation indicative of conflicting interests. When two people claim something contradictory, it will become clear that one of them is mistaken. When two nations have to do something diametrically opposed, they just have to do it. Believing one can, by aligning with the opinions of one side, sweep aside those of the opposing side, is just as clever as saying, "You've drawn me a tree with a branch here and others there. That's totally wrong. The tree looks like this." The other then draws a tree with branches there, here, and yonder, and so on. They have simply drawn it from opposite perspectives. These can, of course, be brought together. But what transpires in world history cannot be settled by simply combining perspectives. When folk souls, with their differently constituted consciousnesses, have to carry out deeds through human beings, it is not possible to judge in the manner of "he is right, he is wrong." But there are contrasting interests which have of necessity to be discharged in phenomena, of which those of today are an example. In such cases, one doesn't refute what is claimed by each side. Just as little as one ought to believe that the karma of one party is less independent than that of the other, equally little ought one to believe that in using the assessments of one side, one can disprove those of the opposing party. 4. One people may have interests against which, for statesmen of another people, it would be a dereliction of duty not to stand in opposition, whereas for statesmen of the first people, it would be their obvious duty to defend them. Human conclusions, opinions arrived at within our consciousness while living on the physical plane, in our physical bodies, are only applicable in the field of reasoning. They are dialectically equivalent, each cancelling out the other. The consciousnesses of folk souls work differently. They also have views that vary among themselves, but theirs are not merely reasoned opinions. They are facts. They are actuality itself. When in the human sphere, one opinion eliminates the other from the field, this doesn't hurt, though one does kill without seeing it as death. However, what holds sway in the consciousnesses of folk souls is quite different. It is not mere abstract reasoning acting dialectically, but it has the effect of deeds rebounding off each other. You need to understand the requirement, the iron necessity, that matters stand as they do. To some extent, you have to allow for the possibility of accepting into your feelings a form of judging, a spiritual form of discerning, which does not correspond with everyday concepts of spiritual forms. We need to think simultaneously with folk souls rather than with individual human souls. When thinking with individual human souls, it is quite natural
to try not to form opinions that contradict another's view, because that would imply not living sociably among our fellow humans. When empathizing with the way in which folk souls think, there are times when it is impossible to enter into them in any other way than by identifying with them and deeming their content to be justified, without detaching from that folk soul, without comparing what they are obliged to carry out with what another folk soul is required to do. For that is a matter for the others, something which cannot be coalesced into a communal consciousness. It moves from consciousness to consciousness. You will therefore understand that from a perspective such as this, one can ask, what does the German people have to say about its mission, in that it feels its existence to reside in heritage consisting of Fichte, Schiller, and other great figures? It says that what it undertakes today is the outer embodiment of its spiritual mission, and that it is impossible for it not to take action on its behalf. Whoever stands within their folk identity must feel with every fiber of their being this has to take place. Those able to distill what the German people have to do cannot define this as an attack. Attacks and assaults on other nations only begin when the other is berated, sworn at. These are matters that need to be understood particularly deeply. Acting for the true identity of a people means nothing other than what one can compare in individual consciousness with the fact that one can only look after one's own body, see that it is in the best possible working order, yet one cannot do the same for another's body. I beg you to note that here is a thought which sets the direction for discerning, for evaluating, one which can be garnered from spiritual scientific sources. If we gaze into the weaving existence of folk souls, to what lies beyond gazing, to see what transpires externally, I would say that for the spiritual researcher, matters are grave, quite exceptionally grave at the moment. But it also behooves the gravity of these times, when we have seen some of the most extreme acts of war, that we are challenged to found a new culture, one which takes account of what lies beyond the veil of the senses. Those who evaluate external world events in the right sense will be those who see in them something akin to ciphers or mighty cosmic symbols of a totally new dawn in human evolution. I said, not only does reason, with its prejudices, rise up against what spiritual science has to say about the supra-sensible beings behind external events, but feelings and impulsions of will also rebel. They reject it because the soul has to transform itself, has to sense and feel about much else besides. That is what I said. Yes, it really is one of those truths. We sleep not only at night, but in part also during the day. Just that at night our desire for our physical body is so strong that it suffuses our astral body and our eye, hampering our consciousness. If we now, with this same astral body and same eye, descend into our physical body to satisfy that voracity, what we develop by way of consciousness is then flooded with the influences of folk souls. Consciousness is once again suffused, so that though we believe ourselves to be wide awake, an element always remains asleep in us. Basically, part of us is always asleep, and into this sleep can the folk soul work, because it is not the same consciousness with which we reach our everyday decisions. This diurnal somnolence, which is only masked by everyday awareness, also includes the incoming effects of folk souls of other nations. They work in a particular way into slumbering human natures, eliciting, albeit different events than during actual sleep, but nevertheless prompting events on the physical plane. While the German people possessed, for instance, an evolutionary model issuing from the innermost depths of German identity, thanks to Goethe,
it neglected this in favor of embracing Darwinism. Just as the Italians were to develop the sentient soul, the French the intellectual soul, the British the consciousness soul, so the German was to develop their I capital. Much in the essential being of the German people becomes understandable if one can feel and focus on how everything constituting German culture wells forth from out of their I. The way in which their I is bound up with their most sacred spiritual treasure is a characteristic of the Central European human being. This can be seen particularly graphically in one phenomenon. If we take occult truths themselves and look westward, external culture has little connection with what manifests as occultism or mysticism. They remain as two parallel streams. You won't find much concerning occultism in the average Paris bookshop. You will have to go to a specialist supplier. Now see how the matter lies in a German, how everything proceeds from the I, in such as Jacob Boehme, how the evolution of German culture is unthinkable without occult impacts of this kind. Think of Goethe and Lessing. Here there are not two parallel streams, but one stream, in which life is suffused and saturated with spirituality, to the extent that you could not subscribe to the materialistic notion that Christ could reincarnate in a physical human being in the way promulgated by Star of the East. That is why the necessity arose, similarly to the present antagonism between Germany and England, a necessity that could not be delayed in leading to war, to separate German occultism cleanly from English occultism. Some may wonder why such a sundering had become necessary. I just wanted to hint at this. Some will actually see a kind of archetypal image in the alignment of facts, or the justification of facts, when reading the letters between Gray and Annie Besant. Their manner of proof and the way it is composed show a great similarity in both. With this, I merely wish to indicate that what proceeds from the German people is connected with its inmost soul. If a German is alert, I say this as a fact without sympathy or antipathy, they will hold with the profound theory of evolution put forward by Goethe, who lays out the sequence of organisms, but who obtains the impetus for their array from the deepest recesses of his eye. Half a century later, from out of the consciousness soul, Darwin reproduced this, but with a materialistic complexion. The world understood this more easily, and even the German world preferred to take up a theory of evolution in Darwinian guise than in Goethean coloring. From the depths of essential German entity, Goethe also founded a color theory, which physicists to this day regard as nonsensical, because the external world has adopted Newton's theory of color. When were Darwin's and Newton's theories of evolution and color taken up instead of those conceived by Goethe? When, among the German people, folk were asleep, and another folk soul could exert its influence instead. Here we have sleep in the midst of waking, and when people are jarred into wakefulness, they still misunderstand the issue but notice that something is amiss. Then they head for their trinket box to take out the insignia they have been awarded by English fraternities, returning them but forgetting to also return that English-tinted theory of evolution and that Newtonian color hypothesis. One could cite a strand of Haeckelianism as a good example. Certain things can be experienced here. For example, even today you can experience and hear that in a particular scientific society, a lecture has been doing the rounds in various German towns on the subject of how international people's organizations have been damaged by this war, and attention being drawn to what, were you to measure it on a larger scale, would be quite correct, but not on the scale that this speaker with his habitual professorial frame of reference could proffer. Taking scale as a starting point, it sounds very odd when this fellow says, internationalism must be resurrected as soon as this war is over, because otherwise Germany will fail to benefit from a great deal, and certain metaphysical elements previously unfolded by the German people might arise again. He said he was happy that this German spirit, with its leanings toward the supersensible, had been swamped by nations with little inclination toward the spiritual. This could be heard during a primarily politico-economic lecture recently, the fear that the German spirit might awaken. Much could be said, but I just wanted to give expression to one or two aspects of what can be gained if we take what is albeit bitter to a superficial view of life with sacred seriousness, with a seriousness that streams into us like a magical zephyr when we receive spiritual science in its full profundity. It is incumbent upon us to ponder this, to feel this, to sense it in these times. And with such feelings we may be vouchsafed an overview of our time and may feel united with those who are outside, abroad, and having to stand up with their blood and souls for all that karma is demanding. So let us embrace what our knowledge and our task ought to be and what is intended to awaken our caring. With the words, quote, "From the courage of fighters, from the blood on fields of battle, from the grief of the bereft, from the sacrifice of people, there will grow fruit of spirit. If spirit conscious, souls will turn their thoughts to realms of spirit." Close quote. End of lecture 2.